Okay, we were talking about the Clonmany Road. A caller says, I agree with Colette. It's dangerous and treacherous. Get the council to do something. Julie on Facebook, totally agree with Colette from Clonmany. That road is very dangerous. Another, totally agree. Everyone promoting the Wild Atlantic Way. And I'm thinking, stop. No more tourists, please. Pat Gallagher, wall around Old Donegal sounds very good sometimes. Have to agree, I'm a cyclist and that road is a disaster. That comes in from Ray. Ray, thank you very much for that. Greg, could you please find out what is happening? The Tank Road in Remelton, they're widening footpaths at the chapel and as for the road at the school, it's a disaster. You can barely get one car through. There's going to be a collision on the Tank Road as cars keep going up as the road is closed. Don't know what the story is there. Anyone further information or further commentary, please let us know. Hi, Greg. Some dog owners feel entitled to let their dogs run free. They equate their dogs with humans. At Ludden Beach, there is a sign asking people to keep their dogs under control. Most days, you play dodge the dog and dodge the dog poo. These owners give good dog owners a bad rep. That comes in from Kate. Thank you very much for that, Kate. Right, okay, let's say good morning now to Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer, author of a new book. It's called The Cancer Guide. Thank you very much for joining us, Professor. How are you keeping?
Hi, Greg. Can you hear me okay? Loud. I have the usual clear. Zoom panic here.
That was on our side, which we resolved. Thanks very much,
no,
though.
No, I wasn't looking to apportion blame. I'm just checking you can actually hear me now.
Loud and clear. Now, just for those who don't know, Professor O'Dwyer is a clinical professor at Trinity College Dublin and a psychiatrist with almost four decades of clinical experience and has worked at the Maudsley and Addenbrookes Hospitals and long-term at Trinity College and St. James Hospital in Dublin. So what, gap in the market sounds sort of so crude and blunt, but what why did you think it was important to put this book together in the way in which you did?
Okay, so that's a good broad question. And the answer is, as you said, Greg, I've spent many years working in St. James's Hospital in Trinity with people who've got cancer. And my interest is in the psychological impact of cancer and its treatment, and most importantly, in how people reclaim their lives afterwards. And even though in 2024, as you know, the rates for cancer have improved so much, it's been detected earlier, treatments are better, people are surviving for longer, it still has a huge human impact on people. People describe it as, when they hear the words that they've got cancer, that it's like being hit by a bus. They watch their lives head up into the air and they're waiting to see where the pieces would fall. And so there's still that huge fear and so many other emotions about cancer. And in looking after patients, they would say to me, if only I had known. If only I had known that this is normal to feel terrible or afraid or distressed or angry or all those emotions. And most importantly, when I would most commonly see people would be when their treatment ends. So they would have all these understandable hopes and expectations of how it would be when their treatment ends. They'd be so delighted. They'd ring the date in the calendar. They'd plan parties, dinners, and then they'd get to the end of treatment and they would feel just terrible.
Yeah, but it's just demoralized. You would have seen so many different scenarios and circumstances. Yes. And whilst all are different fundamentally, there's an awful lot of crossover of things you see. And I think you go through those in the book and it's in very simple terms, but detailed terms, if that makes sense. I'm on about simple to the reader. So just one part here, and I want you then to explain why you went down this route. So initial reaction to a diagnosis of cancer, you talk of fear and distress, a brief outline of that, what people fear, what impact the fear has on them, what are the effects of the impact, and then what to do about it. So that's pretty much covered in, you know, 2.5 pages or 2 pages, really. Is that what you wanted to achieve, that you that people can relate to what you're talking about, but then also very quickly sort of maybe get them to deal with it and understand it?
So I suppose the book is written in a way that people can dip in and out of the book as they choose themselves. And as you said, there's lots of different people and different ways that people respond and different types of cancer. So what I did was I used stories of real people, although anonymized, to give their voices and how they managed. I think people vary hugely in how they manage cancer and how they will manage its impact. So it can be quite a slow process. And in fact, there's a repetition in the book because, of course, initially when they hear the words "you've got cancer," they have all these emotional responses. And then when they start on their treatment, they have other responses as well. So you will see that throughout the book, there's information given at different times. And a lot of times there's overlap, as you said earlier yourself. I think information is power. So if people understand what's happening and have some information about what to expect, it can help them to prepare and not have that huge gap between how they thought they would be and how they actually are, because that's often the most cruel for people.
However people sort of deal with it outwardly, you seem to want people to face the cancer.
Well, no, what I would like is for people to understand what may happen to them, understand the whole range of emotions that can affect them, and then they can choose themselves how they manage it. So you'll see that I say that some people are not naturally very extrovert. They're not people that have lots of friends and like to chat. And those people may well want to manage their cancer in a very private way, but they can privately be terrified. And so the idea is to give people the tools to manage in their own way how they want to manage their cancer. But it is about helping to unhook people from the fear or the shame or the anger or the guilt or whatever those emotions are. And for them also to realize that physically it is grueling as well. So many people are physically exhausted as well as psychologically exhausted at the end of their treatment.
What are myths and misinformation that you're hoping to combat in this book? What give us some examples of what we're talking about there.
A great question, Greg. There are so many. But I suppose my number one myth, my heart always sinks when people come into me and say, oh, apparently with cancer, you're supposed to, because invariably it's unattainable what they've read. But the biggest myth that really bothers me is the concept that you've got to be positive all the time in order to beat cancer. So those are the two things, I suppose. The second bit about beating or battling. Most people are struggling to get out of bed in the morning on their chemotherapy or tie their shoelaces. So this concept that it's a battle, it's not very helpful. Most people are struggling to just get into the hospital, get their treatment and get home again. And the related myth that you have to be positive all the time, it's just not possible in life, even without cancer.
So if that is the language that we use and what the perception is, does that make then people make a difficult situation even worse, that they're not meeting societal expectations or they're not brave or they're weak or like, in other words, can it compound?
All of those things, Greg, that just actually distresses me because it's so difficult for people with cancer. And in fact, I've had amazing texts from people in response to the book saying, look, thank you so much for saying this. It's difficult to manage every day. If there are people that it helps them to think that they're in battle or so, fine. But for most people, that is just not the scenario. They are just trying to survive and get through their treatment and get to the end of their treatment and live for their families and themselves.
It's interesting because I think, and it's related but unrelated, I'm not going to get into it now, but I've expressed in this program before a little bit of the way we talk about mental health, and the journey of mental health for me is a little bit the same. But as I say, we'll not dig into it now. So that what you're saying resonates with me, but it's often, you know, oh, this is what I have. Oh, the journey's really tough and yay, everything's great now. Like, you know, it's not like that for a lot of people. And then people, I think it makes it difficult as they try and meet these expectations.
Well, it's interesting, Greg, but I'm sure you'll have seen there's a bit in the book where I talk about the double, what is often very stigmatizing, where people also hugely struggle with the concept that they might have psychological struggles while they've got cancer. So yes, in a way it is relevant. And I told the story of one person who felt so stigmatized because they had feared all their life they would get cancer. And they'd also feared all their life that they would have mental health issues. And now they were seeing a psychiatrist. And for that, for them, that was just so difficult. So absolutely.
And I suppose to some extent, life goes on. You discuss many things, including, you know, managing intimacy, potentially infertility, stuff that doesn't always come up in conversations when you try and discuss these things, probably because they're so personal.
Yes, and I think that's another very important point. Many of these things are very personal. And one of the things that people who have cancer say is that their privacy has been invaded. They feel so much on display. If they've lost their hair, everybody assumes that they're on chemotherapy, and people will stop, I'm sure meaning well, but say to them, oh, you poor thing, do you have cancer? And they're, you know, they're often very private. They don't want to discuss it. And exactly as you say, picking up life, reclaiming life after cancer is a huge challenge that, again, often people aren't informed about. And so they imagine they'll get to the end of the treatment and life will be as it was in the past.
Yeah.
And it never is.
No, and also too,
none of our lives are.
For sure. So, and another thing we talk about a bit on this show as well, quite a bit on this program too, is the fear of cancer returning, or secondary cancer, or... Yes. That, you know, I think, and it's often women, they come back and, you know, we use the words, got the old clear, and everyone around them's got, right, yes, that's it, line drawn, let's carry on. But for the person that's gone through that treatment, very quickly sort of the doubts can reemerge, or the stuff that needs to be handled there so that they can get on with their life as best they can.
That's exactly right, Greg. And that's why the later bits in the book are all about that, how to reclaim your life after cancer. It's very difficult. I mean, getting through treatment is phase one. Then there's rehabilitation, and then there's stepping out to reclaim your life. Now, the only thing I would say is many people have said to me, you know, my life was in bits, etc. But they choose to pick it up in different ways. They say they reassess their lives and say, I'm not doing that job that I didn't like, or I'm not commuting for 5 hours a day, or I'm not meeting all those people that actually made me feel worse after meeting them. So there's quite a bit of work about that and help about that, how to manage social interactions.
And I think too also that people around those with cancer probably could do with reading a book like this as well, because that person that decides that they're not going to do this, not going to do that anymore, those around them might go, she's gone off the rails, what's going on? But really, they're just making their own choices for them, you know, and that's what we talk about, things changing, you know, and people around someone with cancer have to recognise that as well.
Yes, because exactly as you've said, Greg, cancer never just affects one person. The person with cancer is in the middle, but around them are all the people that care about them hugely, who are also very distressed. And then people in the wider field, their friends, their work colleagues, their people in their local clubs, all wondering how to manage and what to say. And I do give examples of the sort of things that people can say meaning well, but can often not have perhaps the effect they intended. So there's lots to read about and to know about.
How do you strike
my experience of listening to people with cancer,
which is quite an extensive experience? How do you strike the balance at whatever point this might become a factor after diagnosis or whatever, of looking after yourself and dealing with the emotions yourself and counselling everyone around you? I'll be okay, things are going to be fine, I'll get through this. How does someone strike that balance themselves individually, what works best for them, or is there advice in that regard?
Do you mean friends and relatives?
I have to speak to people, right, and they get this news, okay, and it's devastating to them.
Yes.
But then they find themselves having to go into the position of a counsellor to sort of make everyone around them feel that everything's okay.
I don't think they should be doing that. I mean, I feel very strongly that people with cancer have enough to be getting on with to manage themselves and not have to be managing everybody else around them. You know, this is their difficult moments, and I think they have to be allowed to manage it as they would like themselves. I do suggest that what can be very helpful for someone with cancer, I have found, is if they elect one key person that they really trust who can manage things for them. And they say to that person things like, please tell people this is what I will need help with, you know, the washing, the shopping, the cooking, whatever. Can you organise all that? And please also tell them that I just don't want to talk about things at the moment. So when they call to the door, they can leave the shopping or whatever, but I will be very grateful, but not able to talk to them. So I think electing a key person that you trust to manage that for you is important.
They're like the firewall almost, is it?
Well, a support wall, let's call it a support wall.
Can you talk to me a little bit about the section, the cost of honesty, where you talk about, you know, that doctors must be honest, but then sort of go on in beyond that?
Oh, yes. Well, I suppose what I was talking about there is a very long time ago when I first started, which was a very long time ago, and I started in hospital medicine first, and you know, back then, the approach was very paternalistic. I remember being on ward rounds where somebody would be told, you've a bit of a shadow, we'll take it out. And obviously, that was very problematic for people who didn't have information about what was happening to them. Now we've swung to the other extreme where, you know, I have come across patients having been left with 10 academic papers from The Lancet on whether or not they should have adjuvant chemotherapy and the risks and benefits. That is too far. You know, that is too far. So I think there is a balance. And again, I think we should be guided by the patient. I think patients should be, you know, you say to a patient, what would you like? What do you know? What more information would you like to hear? And ask and answer their questions. Because really, somebody with cancer is in a very vulnerable position. They're frightened. They're afraid for their life. They're often in an area they have no expertise in, and they are waiting and dependent on the person who's seen them to share their expertise. But that needs to be done in a meaningful way. That's my opinion.
Okay. The book is The Cancer Guide, How to Nurture Wellbeing Through and Beyond a Cancer Diagnosis. It's very accessible. As you say, it's not a, for some it may well be, it's not necessarily a front cover to back cover read. You dip in and out of it. But I think sometimes too, that these types of books are interesting for anyone to read, because I think it's good knowledge to have. And it might apply to cancer, it might apply to other things. There's a lot of crossovers. I don't think sometimes we always have to get these books just because it is there's a cancer diagnosis in the family or that for yourself. I think that you can grow reading because you're understanding people and how they work and how they feel. Right, okay. And it's available as usual, I'm sure, from all good bookshops and a couple of dodgy ones maybe as well.
No comment, but thank you very much.
It's broadly available. It's just this phrase.
It is very broadly available.
All bookshops are good, really, is the point that I'm making.
All good bookshops, exactly.
All right, Professor Anne-Marie O'Dwyer, author of The Cancer Guide, thanks for your time this morning. I greatly appreciate it. Okay, have a lovely day. Take care of yourself. Okay, it was flagged earlier in the year, but this morning Ryanair officially launched its round twice weekly service from City of Derry Airport to Birmingham. Jade Kerwin is head of communications with Ryanair. Hi, Jade.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks so much for having me on.
Good to have you on board. Right. Now, how does a connection like this come about? What is the process, Jade? Do the airport suggest it to you? Do you look at the numbers and go to the airport? How does it work?
Chance, it's kind of a complicated web, I suppose, that I don't want to get kind of into too much detail on it, just given the intricacies. But basically, we look at different things like demand, we look at viability of the route, and equally where our aircraft are based then as well, and to ensure that we can deliver a prompt, kind of regular on-time service that ties in with the rest of our network. But as you mentioned, Joe, we are launching Birmingham here from City of Derry Airport. Our first flight's departing later on today. So we're all very, very excited. You can probably hear a bit of excitement in the background. And I suppose our decision on that route was the fact that we do think it's going to be very, very popular, Joe. It's adding to our UK connectivity from the airport here and building on our weekly, our 4 weekly services to Manchester that we currently operate at the moment. So from today, we're going to be operating two weekly return services to Birmingham. Again, as I say, building on our UK connectivity. And it's really just facilitating those people who want to travel over, whether it's for business, whether it's for study, whether it's for just visiting family and friends, a chance just to get away for a little bit of a break. And again, you're kind of operating on Wednesdays and Saturdays, so it's kind of 3 days to be able to travel over and back for a short break or a long stint, equally if you like as well.
Yeah, because there are strong connections between the northwest of Ireland and Ireland as a whole to the Midlands for historical reasons. You know, people that emigrated to work and what have you. We often think of London or Glasgow, but Birmingham, a lot of Irish in Birmingham too.
100%. And I suppose that's what's important as well, is keeping that connectivity. I say whether it is for work, whether it's to friends or family, but there has been that so long-term, I suppose, connection. With both countries, so I suppose it's important to have maintain that and kind of keep that going as well.
Is there can you guess or maybe you know because obviously we always think of going out, but there's also inbound traffic. You know, people from the Midlands deciding to say, look, I'd love to see the northwest of Ireland. What is the sort of balance do we normally see between, you know, it's going out from Derry and returning versus going out from Birmingham and returning to Birmingham or some other regional part of the UK?
Yeah. 100%. I think that's always kind of the story that gets a little bit lost. So I think a lot of people think about the people in the kind of surrounds of the airport and people heading off on their holidays, when you think of planes, you think people traveling away to get a break, but then as they kind of miss the flip side where it does have an economic value as well, delivering inbound tourism. And I suppose where I don't have the direct list, but we are going to be carrying about 100,000 passengers this summer across the two routes. And again, that's up about 35% from what we would have done last summer. So it, again, it's really, really strong growth there as well. And like I was looking at our flights back from Manchester towards next week, and they're both sold out. So even the load factors and that then as well is showing that there is that strong kind of demand.
People will remember flying to the sun from Derry on an Ryanair airplane. Do you ever see these things, you probably don't have any information to hand, but do you see that happening again into the future?
I don't think we'll see anything in the forthcoming season anyway. Definitely not in summer, and probably not for the rest of this year. I'd say, look, we kind of operate what I suppose feeds the demand, is probably the best way to put it, that we have at the moment. And we do find, I'd say, that the UK connections are working very, very well from here. So we do offer sunshine routes from the likes of Belfast, which I know is about an hour down the road.
And Knock as
that
well, too. Yeah.
So happy to kind of. Yeah, exactly. And Jules, we do find that people are kind of happy to travel a little bit, because typically if you're going to a sunshine destination, you kind of are going for a bit of a holiday or a proper breakaway, so you probably will spend a little bit longer there. You tend to be happier to kind of put in the extra few miles to kind of get there as well.
No, it's OK. Listen, Jade, thanks for your time. I suppose anything that sees that airport more busy is good for the region. Thanks very much for your time. Take care.
Thank you so much. Very much appreciated.
Bye-bye. Jade Kerwin, Head of Communications with Ryanair there. It used to be really handy if you were heading to Portugal or where have you. 0860 25,000, WhatsApps and texts to that number. Now, we had a question in from a listener. This might have been while I was off, or maybe it never aired, I don't know. But we were contacted by a listener, and the contact read as follows. My husband recently received a bill from Letterkenny University Hospital and was wondering if this was normal procedure, and the fact that this is 5 years since his road traffic collision. So he was in LUH 5 years ago following a crash and then got a bill from the hospital. So we contacted the HSE, as we do on your behalf. And it reads as follows. All invoices in respect of the care of patients are issued on a timely basis as per the requirement of the HSE National Financial Regulations. Normally, in the case of RTCs, the individual will advise the hospital of the name of their solicitor who's dealing with the case, and it's practice that all further correspondence is sent directly to that solicitor. Patients are asked to keep in contact with the patient accounts department to provide an update on their claim. On occasions when no update is provided by either solicitor or the patient, then details of the outstanding debt is again notified to the patient. In all cases, the original correspondence would have been notified to the patient. If this patient wishes to make a direct contact with the patient's accounts office, we'll be happy to provide them with a full outline of the dates of when the original correspondence was issued to them. Hi, Greg. I know it's a difficult subject to bring up, but I don't think people should be allowed to place permanent headstones along the roadside where a loved one has died. It must be awkward for councils if road widening was necessary in those places. It is a tough one to bring up. And, you know, you can ask 10 people and they'll have different views on that. I understand why it's done and why it happens. I understand why then it could be complicated down the line. And you do see them very sadly because of the amount of road traffic collisions that we've witnessed, that you do see them really quite regularly. But this caller believes that they should not be allowed to place permanent headstones along the roadside where a loved one has died. Hi, Greg. Re your earlier conversation about a loose dog in Swan Park. We are weekly visitors to Glenveagh Park. I haven't gone to Glenveagh in a while. I must do that soon, actually. That'd be quite nice. We are weekly visitors to Glenveagh Park, and even with signs and Facebook posts, people still don't keep their dogs on leads. Some dog owners have no consideration for people who have a fear of dogs. On our weekly visit, it's about half and half dogs on leads versus dogs running free. Really is quite annoying, isn't it?
Business Matters, in association with the ATU Donegal Faculty of Business. Now is the time to realise your potential by enrolling on the part-time degree in business. Only 3 years with just one evening per week on campus. Open up your future by contacting the faculty office on 9186206 or visit atu.ie today.
And in studio with me is presenter of Highland Radio's Business Matters podcast, Chris Ashmore. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, Greg.
How's life?
Wonderful.
How did Easter go?
Easter was grand, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Good stuff.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
All right, we'll get on to some news, and he's not interested in chit-chat, so we'll get straight into it. It's always good for business owners and those working for them to communicate as best they can with each other and their customers. And with that in mind, Chris?
Yes, the Donegal ETB is running a business communications course. It's taking place next Wednesday in the Mount Errigal Hotel in Letterkenny. The course will cover communication styles, the various ways we communicate, negotiations, bargaining tactics, personal styles, emotion, conflict resolution, so plenty there. It's a day-long course and it's fully subsidised by the Donegal ETB, so that's been geared towards business owners and employees seeking to enhance their communication skills.
Yeah, I think sharing sort of experience and networking as well, really vital. Those who know, but those who don't, perhaps don't. Donegal Women in Business Network, really good at sort of, you know, connecting people and, you know, either be it in terms of advice or in business opportunities.
Absolutely. They are hosting a free coffee morning on Friday, the 26th of April. And in essence, it's really a chance to network. You don't need to be a member or even in business to attend. Everybody welcome. And they're hosting this in three venues: the Central Hotel and Leisure Club in Donegal Town, La Papa Coffee House in Letterkenny, and the Ferry Glen Coffee Shop in Derrybeg. So good geographical spread there. It's about bringing people together, having a chat in formal circumstances, and you don't know what leads you could pick up. You can register by contacting the Donegal Women in Business Network.
Right, the Food Academy. Talk to us about that.
Yes, now this was set up back in 2013 through Super Value, Board Bia and local enterprise offices, and it was to facilitate small businesses to get their produce into the Super Value supermarkets, so bigger exposure. There's now over 300 what they call them Food Academy small producers in Super Value. And about half of them who are currently supplying Super Value expect their sales to increase by 50% or more over the next 12 months. So by getting into a multiple, you could be a small producer of cakes,
cheese
or whatever. Or,
yeah.
And obviously your market is going to grow enormously.
I went to cheese and you went to cake. This is sort of what would be described as the artisan food industry. Now, I find that to be very quite lofty language and turns me off a little bit. But I suppose we're talking niche stuff, you know, homemade
stuff. To a degree, yeah. And, it's been a real success story. And basically, this is the time of year to apply. The deadline, why I'm bringing this up, is the deadline is this Friday, April the 5th. So if you go through your local enterprise office, they'll give you the details about the whole process. And, you know, if things go well, you could be selling your wares in Super Value.
Big deal. Put it in front of many, many eyes, which all of that and this area, not completely unrelated to this week's Business Matters podcast.
Exactly. Appropriately, this is also the time of year to apply for the Blos na hÉireann, the Irish Food Awards. Now, many of you may be familiar with the little stickers on various products that will say Blos na hÉireann. It's an attractive little sticker that shows that your company has won. There's gold, silver and bronze. Fallon Moore is the event coordinator for the awards, and she's been telling me more about the whole application process.
So at the moment, it's really the paperwork stage. It's getting the entry form in before the 16th of May. So onto irishfoodawards.com, and then from there it's into the deliveries. So depending on what people make, they get given different dates and locations to deliver, so they're being tasted at their best. So all of those are listed on the website, and we do the tasting right throughout the summer. We start in June and we run through until the end of July. And then our finalists are notified in mid-August, and then we're building up into the event, which will be taking place in Dingle at the beginning of October. The awards will be announced on the 4th of October.
Right, big boost then for anyone successful, Chris.
Absolutely. And the interesting thing about these awards, you know, there's blind taste testing of them. They have a panel of judges. So if you come out on top, it's gone through a rigorous process, yeah. And it's now internationally recognised as a standard. So the guy who actually founded it all, when he started this, there was no a recognised standard within Ireland for food products, and it's a link through University College Cork. So there's quite a lot behind this.
All right, and it's kind of a two-parter, Business Matters this week.
Yes, also looking this week at a survey on broadband usage by businesses. It confirmed that small businesses in particular continue to use the outdated copper broadband. Now, we had that changeover a few years ago from analog TV to digital and Serviu and all that. So there's similarities here that copper wire connections will become a thing of the past as everything moves over to fibre. So there could be implications if you don't adapt. And Ciro's chief commercial officer, Ronan Whelan, I was speaking to him and he's been explaining just what's happening.
The infrastructure has been supplied by air for a large number of years, but that process of moving and turning off that copper network has commenced, and those engagements and dialogues are going forth with the regulator of telecoms called Comrec, and that process has commenced. Comrec have detailed how they think it should happen. So again, I think for listeners, it's not to be probably get into the detail of that, other than to know in the coming months and years, telecoms companies are looking at ways to switch off that copper infrastructure, so that the same way it happened with the TV network and the introduction of Serviu and that kind of stuff, it's the exact same thing happening again.
And I think it's really important for consumers in many different types of businesses. You know, slow card machines in retail can be quite frustrating. It doesn't bother me because I've got the time. I'll just stand and wait. But also access to proper broadband in a restaurant or a pub or something. Now, people might have the views about, I'll put the phone away and chat and all that kind of stuff. But practically, in this day and age, we do need to be able to access, you know, decent broadband. And the fibre gives them that content ratio that allows an awful lot of people on. But management of routers, I'd almost get a van, right, and go round and reset all businesses' routers. 30 seconds, switch it off, switch it on again. It makes all the difference because they're on the side of the road.
Greg, the router man.
I know, because they're on the side of the road, okay? And it's not just those in the building who have the password. Yes. Every car or someone walks past, the phone pings on the internet. These routers that most of them use are domestic routers. They've got very, very little memory. And in no time at all, they become just clogged up and of no use to those inside the building and certainly no use to those outside. But for outside, you have to come in to use it. Just a bit of router management, Chris. It's so critical.
Yes.
It's not life and death, but it's critical, you know, especially if you're on the side of a busy road. But anyway, fibre would help with all that. But there's no point having all of that brilliant fibre going into a crappy router.
Indeed.
All right. Okay. So what else? There's other stuff
and
on
also
the show as
just,
well, yeah?
Yeah, we're just, again, it seems to be deadline time for a lot of things. So just mentioning the business support clinics, which are run by the local enterprise office here in Donegal. They give people an insight into the range of services and supports that are available. There's an online Zoom clinic taking place on Friday next. There's also an in-person clinic at the ATU, the Donegal Killybegs campus, in fact. That's on April the 26th. And Philippa Kennedy, business advisor with the local enterprise office here in Donegal, has been giving more details on that. So that's all in this Sunday's programme.
All right, Chris, thank you very much indeed. It's available right now on our website as well. And just whilst we are talking business, we launched yesterday the Highland Radio Customer Services Award, where you, the consumer, have an opportunity to say a thank you to your businesses. It is the Highland Radio Customer Services Award 2024 in association with our friends at McIlhenny's. They take place on the 9th of June in the Mount Errigal Hotel. You can nominate your favourite business today on our website. It's really, really simple. Health and beauty, house and home, motor, lifestyle, retail, community and personal services, and so on and so forth. Now, you can go on just as a consumer and go, do you know what? I was in such and such a hair salon, and I thought the service was really, really good. So you click into health and beauty, you put in the business name, where they are, the drop-down menu to do the category, so that would be hair salon of the year. And then you just write a wee message, if you wish, and send nomination. It is that simple on our website, highlandradio.com. And what I was really encouraged by yesterday was that on my Facebook feed particularly, so many brilliant businesses reminding their customers to nominate them, which is brilliant. And we need to see more of that. as well. Fantastic. We had 16,000 votes last year. 16,000 votes last year. Let's get it to 20 this year. Just give. It costs absolutely nothing. Just a little bit of your time to give your local business a boost. Right. Ivan Yates, a former Fine Gael minister and co-presenter of what's proven to be a really popular podcast, the Path to Power podcast. Ivan Yates, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
After years of engaging with you and you being quite negative and critical about Donegal, I feel things are being rehabilitated now, Ivan. I think things are feeling good now that you realise us in Donegal watch and listen to podcasts as well. Things are improving. What do you think? Bridges are being built.
Well, yeah, no, I'm always alert and alive to what's happening in Donegal because it's a 5-seat constituency, and I think the way Donegal goes, unlike in previous decades, the rest of the country could follow.
Yeah.
But there's been a number of developments this week, and we have sort of entered a very time in politics.
Yeah, Ivan, yeah. Can I ask you a simple question that keeps being asked of me and I don't have the answer? And it is this: what's going on in Fine Gael? That, you know, because people are going, what? Leo Varadkar, young fella, he's packed in politics. You know, Simon Coveney, why is he pulling out now? And then so many others not seeking re-election. So I'll put the question directly to you, as that's been put to me. What's happening in Fine Gael?
It is the end of an era. Fine Gael have been in continuous power since 2011. In fact, Leo is the longest serving Fine Gael Taoiseach ever. And you know, they just have the miles on the clock. They had 76 TDs elected in 2011 after the Troika and Fianna Fáil's sort of combustion. And a lot of those people, and this is a trend you're going to see in all parties, the idea of someone like Richard Bruton spending 42 years in the Dáil is not going to happen again. Mm. People are going to do 20 years plus, and the churn of TDs is going to increase. That's the first thing. The second thing, there is an element of rats off a sinking ship, insofar as, 2011, 76 seats. 2016, 50-odd seats. They went down 15 seats to 35 last time. I'm predicting on the podcast they'll get about 25 the next time. There are 43 constituencies. They face two, as do Fianna Fáil, two horrendous challenges. Those under 35, voting Sinn Féin, bitter about housing, the boomer generation, the increase in asset prices, house prices, relative to incomes, has put them beyond reach and affordability. But there's a second threat, which is those over 55 who would not be likely to vote left or vote Sinn Féin are now looking towards independence. And what's happened since I spoke to you last in January in the polls is that the surge to Sinn Féin, which came from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, has dissipated from 35 to 25% for Sinn Féin, but that 10% has not gone back to Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, and has gone to independence. And I'm now predicting that you could have a situation that Sinn Féin will still be the largest party, but that there could be over 40 independents, which will make government formation next time extremely difficult.
And what you're seeing now, and it's quite, you know, we're seeing it, it's probably not the first time, but I don't recall it being as obvious as it is that parties sort of seeing which way the wind's blowing and struggling to make sure they have the best chance in the locals, and the Europeans probably getting pressure from candidates, but also as we head towards a general election, everyone seems to be shifting position left, right and centre.
Yeah, the reality is, if you look at it from Simon Harris's perspective, he has the Fine Gael Ardèche this weekend. It was always the plan that he would take over from Leo. Leo brought forward rather abruptly his tenure. The idea would be that he would sort of go down with the sinking ship, a bit like the Costa Concordia. I don't know if you remember it, when the ferry ran aground, the first person to get off was the captain. There was a touch of that with the Leo thing. But the reality is, therefore, Harris came in 6 months or a year before it was anticipated he would. But the job remains the same. Fine Gael need to go, no matter what their size after the next election, into opposition. And in the same way that Micheál Martin was elected Fianna Fáil leader in February 2011, they went on a month later to get their worst ever result, 19 TDs. Was Micheál Martin blamed? No. He inherited the circumstances And I see it very analogous for Simon Harris, that he's on the long trek to rebuild the party. Well, one of the difficulties he has is people can ask, what is the difference between Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil? There doesn't seem to be a cigarette paper between them, difference in policy. And, you know, to an electorate that's only mildly interested in politics, they understand the sort of emphasis on the market economy and all of that. But really, they're competing with each other for the same vote.
What kind of independents are likely to be successful? Because we're going to see now another round of, you know, top secret bartering where Fine Gael or Fianna Fáil Light independent will try and secure something for their area. I think the public tuned into this, probably a bit switched off by it, so to speak. And I don't think it does independents any favours, any of that. I could be wrong, but that's just how I feel. So what kind of independents do you think will do well in the general election?
Okay. Well, first of all, I in a professional capacity, emceed a gig in Enniscorthy for Verona Murphy, whereby she launched a slate of 10 independent councillors. And I did a kind of rosary interview with them, and I was shocked 700 people were there. More people were there that night, 2 weeks ago, than were at the Labour National Conference in the Helix.
Wow.
So watch out. There is a zeitgeist. So when I listened to carefully, what is the thing? Michael McDowell was there and so on. So first of all, there's a feeling that the parties put the party before the country, that the top people put their career before their community. And the kind of policy issues that they're kind of sort of loosely uniting against are against the imposition of migrants in a disproportionate way, against some of the sustainability and Green Party agenda. And what I see is because the system of funding political parties doesn't work. A new party, you can't raise money privately through voluntary contributions, and you can only get money after the election. Whereas independents actually get this allowance of 30 grand and that allowance and so on, and they are actually well funded. So what I see is a possibility after the election that you would have a charter put together of some key principles and so on, and that a group of maybe a dozen might come together, accept a whip. This happened before with Shane Ross. Have cabinet representation, junior ministers, have Senate nominations, and a deal could be done. Now, put it like this, it is a very fragmented situation. It's very fluid, but that's the sort of picture I see emerging post-election.
There are those who harbour the views that you have, anti-immigration and what have you, and they would be seen as extreme. I don't like far left, far right, but anyway, they'd be seen as quite extreme in their views. And in the past, in local elections, general elections, they've got a couple of hundred votes and have been laughed out of the room. Do you think we might see, and there are a number of them that have built their profile now, however big, it's hard to judge. Do you see some of those types of candidates be more successful in this, say, for instance, the local elections, the most the elections coming most soon?
I get the point, the kind of visceral anti-refugee stuff. You see a lot of it on Twitter and so on. I think they're limited in the market, but I think some will be elected. I think there's a feeling that there's a kind of Dublin consensus, politically correct, the media are in on it, and people feel talked down to and excluded. I think they will tap into that, but basically, I think whoever is the highest profile on Highland Radio about Micah, about whatever the issue is of the day, Letterkenny Hospital, those are the people. And it doesn't really matter what label they're on. It'll be more a vote for the individual who seemed to be working on the ground, who seemed to be connecting with the local people. And you know what? They could be a bit of a ragbag. There'll be no common denominator between a lot of them.
Yeah, I get you. Just in your experience, politicians that there's one or two politicians that refuse to engage on this programme because of some of the questioning on the issue of the likes of the defective concrete. Does that work in their favour or against them?
I do media training, and I advise people always to embrace the problem. I never believed in the thing when you're talking and explaining you're losing. I honestly believe, how can you expect people to adopt your point of view unless you are passionate about it? And even if people disagree with you, I'm a great believer that you should Always, always. And also, you know what, let's look at the figures. You know, in Donegal, in the morning time, you know, 40% plus of the audience is listening to it rather than national radio. And the truth is, if you're not where your audience is, where your voters are, you're missing out.
Yeah, OK. Ivan, thank you. Path to Power, the podcast, available broadly, of course, on all the usual platforms.
Yeah, Apple, Spotify, the whole lot. It's gone to number one because of the heightened interest in politics and the elections and so on. We've been shocked about that, and it's really going well. And you know, I don't say six of one and half a dozen of the other. I give fortified opinions. You don't have to agree with me, but I think it gives you insights that you won't get in the mainstream media.
Well, you see, I will let you go after this one. You know, another high-profile political journalist leaving journalism to go into government. You talked earlier on about this perception of, you know, a cozy relationship between politics and journalism. And every time we see another high-profile move, that I think just really drives home that is the case. I'm not saying it is. And I think what's happened is with your project there, people are enjoying it, and I hope they enjoy this show too for the same reasons, is that they don't see that cozy relationship, that you call it as it is.
Yeah, and I'm actually in, like, Matt Cooper is a genuine journalist. He asks all the questions like you do. I mean, I have actually been in the sort of editorial opinion space. I did that in News Talk. I did it on the Tonight Show. And, like, all of that, like, I was offered to do a podcast with Sean O'Rourke, and he said, look, in 40 years, I was forbidden to have any opinion. You know, I've always worked on the basis of trying to provoke thought, provoke leadership, thought leadership in terms of that. So therefore, my own particular speak is punditry, is, look, I've been there, done that, and this is what I think is going to happen next, or they're saying this, and this is what they're meaning. But there is definitely a kickback against what I would call the RTE mainstream, Irish Times kind of thing. And I'm not personalising with this.
No, neither
that,
am I.
You know, this is the way you speak. Yeah, this is the way you speak. This is the way you think. And if you think outside of that, you really should be cancelled. I don't agree with that. I think that, you know, you've got to have a national conversation which is entertaining, which is provocative, which you know, is sometimes contrarian. Because, you know, uniform consensus is actually, you know, a death to democracy, in my opinion.
Okay, Ivan, thanks for so much of your time. Have a wonderful day. Take care of yourself.
Lovely to chat to you.
Ivan Yates, former Fine Gael minister and co-presenter of the Path to Power podcast. A caller says, I had cancer 11 years ago. I spent 7 weeks in St. Luke's. I had to pay for treatment in Letterkenny and St. Luke's. It was €850 a night. I wasn't told that you only pay €70 a night. This was in 2013. The other patients had to tell me. All the travel for Donegal people isn't right either. I was in Dublin during the week and back to Donegal at the weekend. I could not get a medical card for love nor money. I had no private health insurance either. Just a couple on our conversation. We've been having as sensitively as one possibly can in relation to the future of the Creche explosion site. I think the shopping facility should be allowed to be rebuilt and put a memorial alongside it. While everyone has sympathy for the families, the communities also need the facilities. No one wants to hurt or upset the families, but mediation needs to be carried out between the owners and the families on this issue. I agree. And Greg, as a resident of Creche, the community needs the shop and the petrol station, but no one wants to offend the families and fully understand their grief. Okay. Listen, thank you so much for all of you who listened to the show, those of you who watched the show, and those of you who texted and called in. Really, really appreciated it. We really appreciate it. We're back tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Stay tuned.